There are certain parshas where, in answer to the question, what happens in the parsha, the only meaningful answer is, what doesn't happen in the parsha? And Bo is certainly just one such parsha, Yetzias Mitzrayim, but there are a couple of plagues yet to go before we actually leave. And I'd like to focus on the psukim that deal with the ninth plague, Makkah number 9, which is Makkas Choshech. And there's a lot that we know, certainly a good deal that we should yet ponder. So the relevant psukim as they begin, Perek Yud Pasuk Kaf Aleph. That's when it starts. The division of the Makos between the Parshas of Va'era and Bo is not equal, perhaps as we might have expected or intuited. It's not 5 and 5, it's 7 and 3. 7 and last week, 3 to go. And in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, it reads, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Nite Yodcha al Hashamayim, stretch out your hand al Hashamayim, and v'yichoshech al eretz Mitzrayim, and there will be darkness. So the darkness begins. A number of the plagues start with, almost all of them in fact, with some type of trigger act, some type of instigating act on the part of Moshe or Moshe and Aharon, or sometimes Aharon, as we saw. Interestingly, on the words al Hashamayim, Rashi makes no comment. Not here. But he does on exactly the same phrase, and I assume that his comments there are equally intended and relevant here, unless someone tells me otherwise. We find, with regards to the most recent plague, Barad in Perek Tes Pasuk Kaf Beis. Perek Tes Pasuk Kaf Beis. Effectively identical terminology, phraseology. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Nete es yodcha al Hashamayim. Once again, that expression, stretch out your hand, al Hashamayim, v'yibarad b'chal eretz Mitzrayim, and there will be hail in Mitzrayim. And on the words al Hashamayim, in that pasuk, Rashi gives two peirushim, two explanations. The first, says Rashi, litzad Hashamayim, towards the heaven, or we would say, heavenwards. Al Hashamayim. Needless to say, what Rashi is responding to is that the words Al Hashamayim literally mean on the heavens, which sounds like you're on top, which we're not, because we're in Mitzrayim. So Al Hashamayim, Rashi renders in a pshat way, Litzad Hashamayim, al means towards the heaven. That's the pshat. But then comes the drash. U'medrash Agoda, and the Medrash Agoda tells us, Higbiho HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe LeMala Min HaShamayim. Hashem lifted Moshe higher than the heavens. Al HaShamayim, according to the Medrash, literally means on top, because Moshe is on top. It's almost reminiscent of Rashi in Parshas Lech Lecha. Vayotzeyoso hachutza. He took him outside. How out is out? Well, it depends. It could be out of the tent, or it could be out of this world. And that is how Rashi explains as well there. Avram is looking down at the stars to count them. So here we have a classic double response, pshat on the one hand, drash on the other. And the reason why, and as I said, I assume Rashi intends the same for our Al Hashamayim, for Choshech, the reason why I think it's so noteworthy is because it encourages us and requires us, in fact, to divide the formulation of pshat and drash perhaps in a way that we might not have done otherwise. We commonly hear, or we may hear, that if you wish to know the difference between pshat and drash, someone once gave me a working definition of the difference between pshat and drash. Pshat is my interpretation and Drash is your interpretation. But if we're looking for something a bit more scientific, so often you might hear that the difference is that the Pshat is the literal meaning and the Drash is the non-literal meaning. That's a commonly held assumption. But a Rashi like this gives us to understand that not only is that not accurate, it is sometimes the opposite of the truth, in the sense that here is a phrase, al hashamayim. If you wish to translate it literally, it means on the heavens. The problem is, what could that possibly mean? And the Pshat says, we don't know. And therefore, one needs to exercise a bit of latitude, a bit of flexibility, in order to get a good Pshat understanding. You actually need to back away from the literal meaning of the word. And even though literally it means on top of the heavens, the Pshat says it means towards the heavens. So actually the difference between Pshat and Drash is not literal versus non-literal, it's straightforward versus not straightforward. That's the difference between them. Sometimes the straightforward explanation cannot be the literal translation. You need to add a bit of subtext or move a little bit to the right, a bit to the left. It's only the Drash is prepared to engage in these words literally. And if the Pasuk says Allah Shamayim, and it sounds like it means on top of the heavens, says the Medrash, that's exactly what it means, on top of the heavens. How can that be? Enter the Medrash. Hashem lifted Moshe on top of the heavens. So as we see in numerous cases throughout, and it's worth keeping an eye on, it's the Drash sometimes that engages in the literal translation specifically, and the Pshat that is non-literal. And I think it's fair to say, as an accompanying statement, the Pshat sometimes does not translate literally because it doesn't have the tools to explain it literally. Because the Pshat has to rely on the meaning of the words, the context, the syntax, Pshat tools. The Drash has so much more at its disposal in order to explain things. It's got such a broader range of possibilities to bring in. That's what equips it, so to speak, with the ability to translate literally. Because if Allah Shemayim means on top of the heavens, and the Pshat says, I have no idea what to do with that, but as far as I know, he's on the ground, says the Medrash, we have access to a much bigger range of possibilities. And he was actually raised above the heavens. Well, if that's the case, then Allah Shemayim can be translated literally. So what I mean to say is, it's specifically because the Drash has more at its disposal to give the answer, that's what allows it to broach the question in the first place as to what the literal meaning might be. So be that as it may, and as I say, well worthwhile bearing in mind, let us come back to Perek Yud, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Nitei Yodcha L'Shamayim, V'choshech Al Eretz Mitzrayim, let there be darkness, V'yamesh Choshech, and let darkness descend. Okay, and Moshe does. And what happens? Let's read the two psukim to see the Torah's description of darkness, and then we'll see where we go from there. Vayed Moshe es yado al hashamayim. Moshe indeed, he inclined his hand heavenwards. Vayi choshech afeilu b'chol eretz Mitzrayim shloshes yomim. And there was a very extreme darkness, opaque darkness, in all of Mitzrayim for 3 days. What were the consequences? Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Lo ro'u ish es achiv. People didn't see each other. Lo komu ish mitachtav. And no one was able to even get up if they were sitting down. Shlosh yom for 3 days. Ulcho b'nei Yisrael hayor b'moshvosam. But for the Jews, there was light. So what the Pasuk is telling us is that you have this plague and it has these effects, and as in the Pasuk's words, this took place over the course of Shlosh Yomim, 3 days. That sounds simple enough. And now, let's look in Rashi. Rashi says, you have this thick darkness, shelaro ishes achiv shloshes yomim. People couldn't see each other for 3 days. Very thick. Okay. Interestingly, one of the classic acharonim, Amincha Belula, I believe is his name, laro ishes achiv, a person didn't see his brother. The darkness was so thick, no light could penetrate it. If you lit a candle, it wouldn't help. If you lit a fire, it wouldn't help. The word ach in Lashon HaKodesh has two meanings. And Lahavdil, I believe, even in modern Hebrew, has the same two meanings. We normally look at the word ach as a brother. But the word ach also means a fireplace. In the Navi, ha'ach, he was the king who took the Megillas Eicha, he threw it into the fire which was in the ach, which was in the fireplace. I don't know that we have such associations with fireplaces anymore, and if we do, we don't like to talk about it for ecological reasons, but Ach is a fireplace. To the extent that the Mincha Belula explains, the ro ish es achiv means you couldn't even see the fireplace. You were right next to the fire, wouldn't help you. Okay, that's for 3 days. And then says Rashi, va'od shlosh yes yomim, and there was another 3 days, acherim choshech muchpal al zeh. That was doubled. If you thought the first 3 days were dark, just wait for the second 3 days. No one could move. Shelo komu ish mitachdav. Yoshev en yochol la'amod. Sitting, you couldn't stand. Omed en yochol leshev. Standing, you couldn't sit. And, of course, the simple question is, how did Rashi get six from three? Rashi says, you had 3 days of this and 3 days of that. That's six. But the Pasuk says three. So where does that leave us? But the answer, of course, is that the Pasuk does say that the Makkah of Choshech was for 3 days. But it says it twice. The end of Pasuk Kaf Beis says there was Choshech Afela for 3 days, Shlosh Yes Yomim. And then the next Pasuk says the people couldn't move, Shlosh Yes Yomim. Why the repetition? And that's where Rashi explains, this is not repetition. One effect was for 3 days, and the other effect was for 3 days. There were 3 days of darkness that you couldn't see through, and then another 3 days, as Pasuk Kaf Gimel describes, that you couldn't move in. And that's why Rashi says that if you tally the 3 days twice, that's why you get 6 days. And interestingly, with this in mind, we go back to the final words of Pasuk Kaf Aleph. Again, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Moshe was told to extend his hand, and there'll be darkness in Mitzrayim. V'yamesh choshech. V'yamesh choshech. What is the meaning of the word v'yamesh? Well, we actually avoided it, which is one approach, but it doesn't take you too far. Rashi actually gives two explanations for the word v'yamesh choshech, and that's the happening word. Whatever is happening is in the word v'yamesh. The first explanation says Rashi of v'yamesh kamo v'yamesh. It's v'yamesh is like v'yamesh with an aleph. How does that help us? Because v'yamesh is like the word emesh, and emesh refers to nighttime, darkness. Rashi then explains how sometimes you can have a word and in its core there would be an aleph, but the aleph can get dropped sometimes. That's what's happened here. It's really v'yamesh, but it's written and it's pronounced. The word now is v'yamesh. So the first perush of Rashi on v'yamesh is from the expression emesh, which means darkness. But then says Rashi, once again, u'medrash hagada. But there's another explanation of v'yamesh, which is lashon mimashesh, which is to feel. Because v'yamesh choshech means there will be a darkness that you can feel. It's tangible. It's thick in that way that it can be felt. And that is the second explanation of v'yamesh. So it's very interesting, because the word is kind of in the middle. V'yamesh could be like emesh, or it could be like mamash or memashesh, like a tangible thing. And if it's in the middle, it's because it partakes of both. But when you think about it, now these two explanations of Rashi on the word v'yamesh choshech actually line up with the two sets of 3 days as to what the nature and the makeup of that darkness was. Because Rashi's told us that for the first 3 days, people couldn't see anything. Absolute darkness. For the second set of 3 days, they couldn't move. That's a different type of darkness. And now we understand that these two types of darknesses are both contained within the word v'yamesh. The first set of 3 days, which is about absolute lack of visibility, emesh, as Rashi said, that's for the first 3 days where no one could see a thing. They could move, but they couldn't see. Lero ishizachiv is v'yamesh as emesh. Whereas the second, where people couldn't move, if they couldn't move, that means the darkness is blocking them. It's physically inhibiting them. That's mamash. That's a tangible darkness. And that's the second explanation of v'yamesh. So far we see there's a kind of a duality that's going through Makas Choshech, starting with v'yamesh, and then dividing into the two sets of 3 days. And then the matter goes further. And Rashi continues. V'lama hevi aleim choshech. Why did Hashem bring darkness on the Egyptians? And he explains, or actually gives 2 explanations. First he says, which is the very sad part of the story, there were many, they're called Rishayim, they didn't want to leave. That's very interesting. Within the context of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the definition of a Rasha is someone who doesn't want to go out. If you want to go out, so you're a tzaddik in that respect, even though there were numerous Rishayim who left. They'll be called Rasha in a different context. Dasan and Aviram left. In this respect, they're tzaddikim. In every other respect, not so good. So there were Rishon who didn't want to leave, and they died out in these 3 days of darkness. Why in the darkness? Because the Egyptians don't need to see us burying those people. The Egyptians shouldn't see their downfall of these Rishayim amongst the Jewish people. And they'll say, oh, so they're suffering just like we are. We don't need that. And therefore it was done under the cover of darkness. Of course, there are logistical questions one could ask. If this is 4/5, as Rashi will tell us in Parshas Bishalach, v'chamushim, 1/5 of the Jewish people came out, 4/5 didn't. What exactly did the Mitzrayim make of it when they got out of their plague of darkness X number of days later and saw 4/5 of the Jewish people not there? Did they notice any graves? We don't know. Did they think they ran away? We don't know. Did they have other things on their mind so that they actually didn't care either way? Possibly. But that was not considered to be a pressing issue. And then, says Rashi, there's another reason why Hashem brought darkness on the Egyptians. V'od, shechipsu Yisrael, the Jewish people were rummaging, v'ro'u es kleihem, and they saw all the valuables and vessels of the Egyptians, u'kesheyotsu, and when the time came to leave Mitzrayim, v'yushol en mehen, and they came to ask the Egyptians to borrow their things, and the Egyptians were stalling a little bit. We don't have. We gave you the office. Omelo Aniri said, no, I know you have. I know where it is. I can tell you exactly where it is. And the game was up. That's very interesting that this was considered a valuable enterprise to allow the Jewish people to preview their things so that they shouldn't, and they didn't take anything. But they know exactly where everything is. Adkan Rashi's explanation. So to summarize, Rashi asks, why did Hashem bring darkness? And he provides 2 explanations. Number one, they shouldn't see the Jewish people burying their dead. And number two, the Jewish people should have access to their valuables to know where things are. What's very interesting is, as Mefarshei Rashi point out, Rashi hasn't really done this. in the other plagues. He does not, as a matter of policy, raise the question, why this plague? Interestingly, the Medrash does. For all of them. The Medrash says, why blood? Why frogs? Why lice? It goes through one by one. There's a lot. The Medrash has a lot to say. But Rashi doesn't quote it. In fact, as a matter of record, the only time Rashi mentions this, interestingly, is in his comments to the fourth plague, Orov. And Rashi then goes back to the beginning very briefly and gives a kind of an overview almost for the Makos. And he explains one or two. He says why attacks the water first. And again, quoting the Medrash, that when one nation wages war on the other, the first thing they do is they attack the water supply. And then they do this and that. And Rashi says, look in the Medrash. He really makes short shrift of the whole discussion. I'll tell you one or two, and then for more details, consult the Medrash. For obvious reasons, Rashi's job is to explain the pshat and the pasuk, not to give the reasons for why things happen. That's a separate question. So if that's true, so we come back to this Rashi, and Rashi gives not one explanation for this ninth makkah, but two. And he's never done that before. Which leads us, of course, to ask, Ma'nishtana ha-makkah zos mikol ha-makkos? Well, why is this one different? But the Maharal explains that it's all a progression. The reason why Rashi is moved to ask what was the reason for the plague of darkness is instigated by what we've already established, that the plague changed halfway through. It was 6 days. Three were one type of darkness, three were another. That's all been told to you by the Pasuk. V'yamesh has those two meanings. There's two sets of three. And if that's the case, then we have a situation with the plague of darkness that we never had before. As far as we know, all the plagues were 7 days long, whatever duration they were. So if the Nile is turned to blood for 7 days, so then it didn't turn into something else halfway through. And the frogs didn't become something else halfway through. But the darkness changed halfway through. And that already, having embarked on this discussion, we need to finish it. And Rashi says, if you wish to understand why the nature of the plague of darkness changed halfway through, we need to approach the question, why was darkness in the first place? And the answer is, for two reasons. As we said, the Egyptians shouldn't see the Jewish people burying their dead, and the Jewish people should have access to their homes to see their things. And when you think about it, says Maharal, that actually corresponds to the two types of darkness. In other words, if the reason for the first reason for darkness was that they shouldn't see the Jewish people burying their dead, so you only need the type of darkness that stops them from seeing. That's the first type. That's Emesh darkness. That's the first set of 3 days. However, when it comes to the second set of 3 days, with the second reason for darkness, which is that they should have access to their homes, so they don't wish to be able to move in order to inhibit them or to stop them or whatever it is. That, for that, you need not just a zero visibility darkness, you need a debilitating darkness. And that's the second set of 3 days. And it thus turns out that the duality within the Makkah, it starts with the word V'yamesh, divides into two sets of 3 days, because each one is serving a different purpose. That's why Rashi raises this question that he never raised before. So certainly, if we may say, casts a lot of light on the Makkah of darkness as explained by Rashi. What's very interesting is, there's one question which is left unaddressed in Rashi, at least here, but it is picked up on by the Medrash. And that is, Rashi tells us, with regards to Makas Dam, the Pasuk only tells us the duration of the first plague, 7 days. But Rashi informs us that this was the norm. This set the tone for all the plagues. They were all 7 days. That being the case, so we're moved to ask, we have three and another three, that gives you six. There's a day missing. Shall we say that all the plagues were 7 days and this plague was 6 days? Says the Medrash, ultimately, even the plague of darkness was 7 days long. Happened to be. We're out of days. Well, move forward to Parshas Beshalach. As the Jewish people are running away, and the Egyptians follow them, and if we can use the expression, cut to the chase, and get to that final, that seventh day, where they're just about to enter the Yam Suf. And the Pasuk says, there was dark, for the Egyptians, there was complete darkness. There was light for the Jewish people. The Egyptians were plunged into darkness. That's the only thing that possessed them to keep moving into the sea. The Pashtus says they didn't know that they were in the sea. As long as they don't feel water, which they didn't because it split open, so they didn't realize that they're moving into the sea. And that was the final installment of Makas Choshech. You had the 6 days as a group, two groups of three within Mitzrayim itself, and then you had what they call in the music business a suspended seventh, which came in Parshas Beshalach, and that was the Vayichoshech Afela. These are the comments of the Mefarshim with regards to with regards to Choshech. I'd like to broaden the discussion a little bit and draw our attention to an aspect of the Korban Pesach, which will ultimately become shed light, shall we say, on Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. And we start actually by a mitzvah which we're not going to meet for a while, and that is the mitzvah of tzitzis. Tzitzis is very much connected to Yetzias Mitzrayim. The parsha of Tzitzis ends, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. And for that reason, Rashi cites his teacher, Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, as expounding on numerous details within the mitzvah of Tzitzis and associating them with Yetzias Mitzrayim. And just a number among them before we get to the one that is of our particular interest to us. The tzitzis are to be placed on the corners of the garment. And the word for the corners is kanfe, al kanfe vigdehem. The word kanfe has appeared already in the Torah with reference to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hashem says, when he speaks to us at our Sinai, va'esa eschem al kanfe nisharim. I brought you out on the famous wings of eagles. And therefore the kanfe nisharim become associated with the kanfe vigdehem, although one is corners and one is wings, but it's a shared concept. Additionally, says Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, it's a garment with four corners, arba kanfos. Why four? Corresponding to the four expressions of geula, botseisi, bitzalti, bigaalti, vilakachti. And finally, eight threads, eight strings. Why eight? Says Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, this corresponds to the 8 days that elapsed from the time we left Mitzrayim until the time that we sang Az Yashir. Thus far from Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. As we know, when it comes to things like this, if you say something which seems to be somewhat inaccurate, you're not going to get away with it. The Mefarshim follow up on this point. Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan says there are 8 days between leaving Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yam Suf and Az Yashir. We happen to know that's not the case. Actually, there were 7 days. We left Mitzrayim on the 15th of Nisan, the Az Yashir was on the 21st of Nisan, and that is 7 days. And Rashi himself says that explicitly in next week's Parsha, and that's why we read Az Yashir on the 7th day of Pesach. So if that's the case, how can the Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan say there's 8 days when there's only 7? And a number of Mefarshim explain as follows. And it will really, I think, give us a new way of looking, open up for us the question of what Yetzias Mitzrayim means, what it means to leave Mitzrayim. By which we mean, the goal of Yetzias Mitzrayim is expressed, as we said, in the final pasuk of the parable of Tzitzis. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hotzeitzi Etzchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Why? Liyos Lachem Lelukim. For us to be Hashem's people, for Him to be our God, specifically, particularly, and for us to be His people. And it's important to realize that if that's the goal of Yetzias Mitzrayim, then that is what defines leaving Mitzrayim, to become Hashem's people. It changes, I think, the way we could potentially even look at Pesach. There's a very interesting comment of the Meshech Chochma in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Dalet. It's a pasuk which we could very easily let go without comment. But Meshech Chochma does not allow us to do that. Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayayom azeh lachem lezikaron. Okay, this day shall be for you as a remembrance. V'chagosem oso chag l'Hashem. And you shall celebrate this day as a festival for Hashem. The doroseichem, for your generations. Chukas olam techaguhu. It is an everlasting statute, mitzvah. You celebrate this day for Hashem. It is an everlasting mitzvah. What does that mean? It says Meshech Chochma in a short statement, but as with many of his short comments, a great deal contained within. There's two ways you can really celebrate Pesach. There's two ways you can look at Pesach. You can look upon Pesach as a festival of our liberation, of our freedom, which it was. But it's possible to see only that. That's not called Chag Lashem. That's called Chag Lachem. That's your celebrating your freedom. And there is what to celebrate. The problem is, if that's what Pesach is, it's not a mitzvah for all generations. It's not an ongoing mitzvah. For a simple reason. The Jewish people do not always have the freedom that they enjoyed when they left Mitzrayim. I think it's fair to say, it's very difficult to say, but fair to say there have been times when the Jewish people have been celebrating Pesach in conditions that paralleled, if were not worse than the time in Mitzrayim. And then what? What nation celebrates its liberation when it's been taken away from it? What nation celebrates its independence when it doesn't have it anymore? That comes and goes. We'd like it to be here. And we hope that it will come back in full, but it hasn't always been there. But the Chag Lashem has always been there. In other words, what we attained when we left Mitzrayim, to become Hashem's people, which was the goal of leaving Mitzrayim, that never left us, in any conditions. And that is a festival that can be celebrated and is applicable in all conditions, in every generation. And that's why the Pasuk says, again, the Pasuk looks so different now. If you celebrate it, Chag Lashem Nedoroseichem, it's a festival for Hashem, with that orientation, with that perspective, with that understanding, it's a Chukas Olam Techagu. We celebrate it each and every year. The implications for us, and this is discussed by the Maharal in the Sefer which he devotes to Yetzias Mitzrayim, Pesach in Yetzias Mitzrayim, called Gevuras Hashem. He says something quite startling. When did the Exodus from Egypt begin? When did it happen? So here comes a bit of a surprise. Of course, physically, we left Mitzrayim on the 15th of Nisan. True. But in terms of the goal of leaving Mitzrayim, to become Hashem's people, the first step in attaching ourselves to Hashem as His people came before we left Mitzrayim, the day before. How so? Because what did we do the day before we left Mitzrayim? We brought the Korban Pesach. Leaving Mitzrayim was for us to become Avdei Hashem. That's why Hallel begins, Hallelu Avdei Hashem, Velo Avdei Paro. No longer servants to Paro, servants to Hashem. That's the full definition. But that definition began to be actualized the day before we left, through Avodah. What is it that Avdei Hashem do, if not Avodas Hashem? Korban Pesach, is Avodas Hashem. And from that point of view, we left Mitzrayim even before leaving. We were free from Mitzrayim. The Exodus had already begun even before we took a footstep out of Mitzrayim. And with this in mind, if we come back, it's such a different now perspective to understand. There's different layers. One could almost say there's two clocks of redemption. If we wish to timestamp the Exodus, we could say in Gashmius, physically, we left on the 15th. But in Pnimius, essentially, we left already the day before. And what are the implications for the mitzvah of tzitzis? Tzitzis as a mitzvah reflects the goal of leaving Mitzrayim. And that's where the four corners take us all the way from Egypt to Har Sinai. Votsesi, Bitzalti, Vigalti, which is leaving Mitzrayim. But then number four, V'lakachti eschem li la'am, is the full redemption. Not just redeemed from, but redeemed to, from Egypt, towards Hashem. That's the fourth expression. And therefore the mitzvah of tzitzis represents the full understanding of leaving Mitzrayim. Well, if that's true, says Maharal, we can well understand where Rabbi Moshe Adarshan says that there were 8 days from when we left Mitzrayim until we sang Shira at the Yam Suf. There were only 7 days from when we physically left Egypt. From the 15th of Nisan when we physically left till the 21st is only 7 days. But from when we conceptually were already free and attaching ourselves to Hashem, that's not the 15th of Nisan. That's the 14th of Nisan with the bringing of the Korban Pesach. From the 14th to the 21st, that's 8 days. That's Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. And how interesting it is, says Maharal, that there are certain, as much as Pesach begins on the 15th of Nisan, which it does, but I don't think we have any other festival where some of the elements of the festival already begin the day before. I think if you think of Sukkot, and Sukkot is the 15th of Tishrei, and what happens on the 15th of Tishrei? Everything. Sukkah, Arba Minim, and all of that. What happens the day before the 15th of Tishrei? Build a sukkah. Or despair. But the mitzvahs don't begin. And so it is with every other chag. If anything, we actually clear the day from the mitzvah. Right? We eat the day before Yom Kippur. We don't sound the shofar the day before Rosh Hashanah. When it comes to Pesach, of course, matzah we don't eat. But the prohibition against chametz is already in play on a Torah level. And the obligation to remove chametz from your house is already in play on a Torah level from the day before Pesach, specifically from midday, because that's the time from which you can bring the Korban Pesach. In that respect, says Maharal, you see how the Torah apportions different mitzvahs of Pesach, some to begin the 15th, but some begin the 14th. Because Pesach itself begins twice in that respect, in terms of these two elements of what Pesach is celebrating. And if we thought that it couldn't get any further, it does. There's one final point, which is literally in front of us in the Psukim. And that is, if we take a look at Pasuk Tesvav, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Tesvav. So let's start from the beginning and get to the point that we wish to. Shivas yomim matzos tochenu, for 7 days to eat matzos. Ach bayom harishon tashbisu sa'or mibatechen. But on the first day, remove chametz, leaven, sa'or from your houses. So the mitzvah to remove chametz from our domain is on a day which the pasuk calls yom harishon. When is the Yom HaRishon? What does that mean? We would think it means, sounds like it means, the first day of Pesach. We know that's not true. Woe to the person who waits to the first day of Pesach before getting rid of chametz from his house. We know that's not true. The mitzvah to remove chametz from your house begins the day before. what is the, how can Yom HaRishon mean the day before? So indeed, the Gemara, and Rashi quotes some of it, explains that sometimes the word Rishon doesn't mean first, but it means prior. And that's what it means in this respect. But Yom HaRishon, the prior day. The Rishon means the day before. Okay. However, amazingly, the Taz, Turei Zahav, and this is not in his commentary on Rashi, which he has, Divrei David. It's in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Taz says, at the end of the day, the simple meaning of the words Rishon means the first. Which means even after Chazal have explained that it's the 14th, it's Erev Pesach, and Rishon means the prior, true. It's all true. And still the word Rishon means the first. Because the Torah chose to refer to the day before Pesach as the first day in order to teach us that from a certain point of view, the 14th is already the first day of Pesach. If what we're celebrating is our freedom, when it happened, part of it already happened at the 14th, at midday, when we started to bring the Korban Pesach. In many respects, and to a significant degree, the 14th is also called Rishon. So there are two first days of Pesach, the 14th and the 15th, which literally correspond to these two elements of leaving Mitzrayim. So I think this really casts many aspects of the Parsha in a completely new light. The very definition, the goal of leaving Egypt, then informs us as to the definition of what it means to leave Egypt. So, let us conclude this evening by referring to, we'll have the pasuk handy, but we'll begin by mentioning a very interesting comment of one of the later Rishonim, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim. And of course, there's plenty of opportunity of the Rishonim to talk about Pesach, this entire Masechta, Maseches Pesachim. And Pesachim begins by talking about Chometz, the search for Chometz, etc. And it's unusual to have a mitzvah to search to remove something. There are many things that you shouldn't have in your house. There's an Isser to have Avodah Zarah objects in your house. But there's no, the rabbis never said there's a mitzvah to search for it by candlelight, etc. It might be there, but if it's there, get rid of it. And if not, then it's not there. And you might find it, and hopefully you won't. But there's a mitzvah to actively search and destroy chametz. Where are the rabbis getting this from? What's their inspiration to mandate an active search to get rid of chametz? Says the Ran, they get it from the Torah. Because you see, the Torah itself has already given us what one could call added measures to protect against eating chametz. What he means to say is, or more correctly, what he says is, there's two prohibitions when it comes to chametz. There's the prohibition of owning chametz and the prohibition of eating chametz. The Torah says you can't own it, and it says you can't eat it. And says the Ran, those two prohibitions are connected. They're so connected that one actually serves to protect the other. Meaning, the reason why the Torah says you can't own chametz is in order to ensure that you won't come to eat it. Get it out of your house so that you don't come to eat it. And why would the Torah, that chametz is not the only thing that you can't eat. There's a number of things that you can't eat. The Torah never says don't own it, that you shouldn't come to eat it. The Ran explains chametz is unique in this way. Because the penalty is very severe, kares. That's a severe penalty for eating. And you eat it the whole year round. So there's no natural, non-kosher food. You don't eat it the whole year round. So it's not around. And you're not used to it. But you're used to chametz. What's life without chametz? The whole year round it's there. So the combination of the fact that there's no natural deterrent and the penalty is so severe, that's why the Torah says, remove her from the premises. So says the Ran. Now what's fascinating about this comment of the Ran, and it's a halachic statement, is that the Ran is introducing us to a category of mitzvah which is called siyag min haTorah, a protective measure from the Torah. What do we mean? We're familiar with all of those words. We know what a siyag is. It's a protective measure. In our experience, protective measures are enacted by the rabbis to protect you against violating a Torah prohibition. That's the relationship. As if to say, whatever's in the Torah is the prohibition, and what the rabbis do is protect the prohibition by protective measures. That's the siyag la-Torah. But that division is not true here. This is an exceptional case where the Torah itself not only provides the prohibition, but also provides the protection. If a person owns chometz on Pesach, so he has violated the Torah prohibition. But that Torah prohibition is to protect against consuming chometz. That's one for the books. Which is fine, because we're in the books. But it's worth noting, siyag min haTorah, the Torah itself protected. Now this comment, or more correctly, this position of Rabbeinu Nissim, again to state it in half a sentence, that the Torah, the reason why the Torah forbade owning chametz is to protect that a person shouldn't come to eat chametz, that explanation did not pass without comment from the Chassam Sofer. And the Chassam Sofer says, at the way I see it, the Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran, has given an explanation that we do not subscribe to, because he seems to have engaged in the area which is called Tama Dekra, presenting reasons for mitzvahs, ascribing reasons for mitzvahs. And what this means is that as much as many mefarshim will advance reasons for mitzvahs, but the point is to make a halachic statement, a halachic position, which could have halachic ramifications. After all, if you say that the reason the Torah forbids owning chametz is to protect against the eating chametz, which is so severe, there's some type of chametz where there is no penalty of kares. Mixtures of chametz, it's also from the Torah, there's no penalty of kares. Can you own that? According to the analysis of the Ran, you can, because it doesn't have that terrible disaster scenario that for which the Torah said you need to get rid of all chametz. So there are halachic ramifications for this explanation. But that seems to lead us headlong into the dispute of, do we do this? Do we provide reasons for mitzvahs that could potentially qualify the mitzvah itself and limit the scope of the mitzvah itself? And this is a famous dispute between two Tanaim, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Within the, and this is the sugya of Darshin and Tama Dekra. What's the classic case before we get back to where we are? The classic case, the Torah says, Lo tachbol beged almana. Do not, if you lend money to a widow, do not take collateral for her. Black on white. It's a negative commandment in the Torah. It's a mitzvah to lend money to everyone, certainly to someone in need, she may be in need. You're entitled to take collateral under normal circumstances, not from a widow. Says the Mishnah, what type of widow are we talking about? Well, if you ask Rabbi Yehuda, any type. The Pasuk says, don't do it. And enter Rabbi Shimon and says the most surprising thing. Specifically if she's poor. But if she's rich, and even rich people need to borrow money, in fact, sometimes they need to borrow more. But if she's rich, it's fine. But if she's poor, that's when it's a problem. That's a proviso, that's a qualification. And why does he say this? So Rabbi Shimon says, because what's the reason why the Torah says don't take collateral from a widow? Because the halacha states, if you take collateral from someone, then when they need that object, you need to return it. So if you take something from her and she needs it, you'll be basically in and out of her house the whole time, and you'll sully her reputation. Masiyah Shem Rabbi Shechein Oseha. Neighbors talk. It's an unbelievable explanation. And therefore, if she doesn't have money, so that you'll need to return the collateral, so that's not appropriate. So the Torah says, so don't do that. But if she has money, so keep the collateral till she repays the loan. So you're not, there's no gentleman caller issues. That's Rabbi Shimon. And based on that, he qualifies the mitzvah. The Torah says, don't take collateral from a widow. A certain type, says Rabbi Shimon. But Rabbi Yehuda says, any type. The Torah says, we can't start advancing reasons. And this is the classic case of Darshin on Taima Dekra. Do we do advance reasons in that way? And the halacha is no. And therefore, to come back to our Chometz situation, says the Chasam Sofer, Rabbeinu Nissim seems to be offside of the halacha as we accept it. Because we say we do not advance reasons for mitzvahs in a way that could affect the halacha. And Rabbi Ran did exactly that, because he said the reason is to protect against the prohibition of eating with all that could be implied by that. So what is the defense of the Ran? Says Rav Zevin, that's all, in his Sefer Moadim Ba'alacha, if there was ever a case of Muat Shemachzik as Hamaruba, the ability to contain so much within such a small amount of space and it still be crystal clear, that was the gift of Rav Zevin in the Moadim Ba'alacha. And he says, it could be that the answer to the Chasam Sofer's attack is in the Pasuk. Which Pasuk? Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Tes. Let's see the Pasuk. Shivas Yamim, Se'or Le'imatzi B'vateichem. For seven days, Lo Yimatze, you can't have it in your house. What we call Bal Yimatze. Here the Torah says, here the Torah is telling us, you can't possess it. And then what does the Torah say? Ki kol ocha machmetzes v'nichrasa ha-nefesh ahim yadas Yisrael. Because whoever eats it, it's going to be chayav kares. Says Rav Zevin, look at this pasuk. What is it doing? It's giving you a prohibition, and then it's giving you a reason. That could change everything. In other words, and in fact the Gemara itself says this explicitly, when do we say that we do not involve ourselves in taima dekra, reasons for mitzvahs? That's our reasons. If the Torah didn't say, so you can't come along and say, well, the reason is such and such, and therefore in this case it would make a difference. You can't do that. That's the halacha. Rabbi Shimon says you can. And we say you can't. And the halacha is you can't. You can't. The Torah can. If the Torah gives you a prohibition and then gives the reason, that's not called expounding the reason for a mitzvah. It's called reading the reason for a mitzvah. It's from the Torah. And therefore, says Rav Zevin, the pasuk seems to be on the Ran side. That gives you the prohibition and then explains why. And that is his defense of Rabbeinu Nissim straight from the pasuk. With regards to the issue of Darshin and Taima Dekra. Expounding, the Ran's not expounding. He's reading. The Pasuk is providing. Ran is not providing. Very interesting. And just for a final one or two moments, again, where could the discussion go from here? It seems like we've reached the end. But as far as the Meshech Chochmah is concerned, we're just beginning. Of course, we ourselves are just ending, but we'll synopsize. What do we know about the Jewish people in Mitzrayim? What was their outstanding merit? They didn't have that many outstanding merits, but some they did. Namely, they protected themselves. All the things that we know. They didn't change their names, they didn't change their dress, they didn't change their language. Whatever lo shinu, wherever you look, there's different lists in different places, but there's sufficient overlap. What does that mean? What do they achieve thereby? That means that they protected their identity. I mean, they didn't really have much else, but that they had. And how do you protect it? By these things. There's no prohibition to dress in a different way. There's no prohibition to have a different name, but they didn't do it because they're protecting themselves. And the truth is, in such a Gentile and a hostile and alien environment with so many forces at play, that's what kept them intact. And says Meshech Chochma, the Jewish people didn't always do that. If you look at what happened to us in Bavel, first exile, 70 years, we practically disintegrated. 70 years. Why? We left the land of Israel into Bavel with the mitzvahs, but with no protection. There was no. That wasn't part of our experience. It wasn't part of our toolbox. And without that, lines were blurred, and the Jewish people fell to pieces. And just a few came back to the land of Israel for the second. And that is why the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, we know it from Pirkei Avos, one of the first things they said is, we got to get ourselves together. Asu siyag la Torah. Protect yourselves. It's important. It needs to be protected. You need boundaries, guidelines, and so on and so forth. And of course, we don't celebrate the fact that we've been in Golus the second time around for that much longer, but we did a lot better than the first time around, and it's because we have these protective measures. And he gives a classic. It's really something. Because in Golus you need protection. And Golus can be anywhere at this stage. There were famous 18 enactments of these protective measures. And the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos says about them, these protective measures are so important, even if Eliyahu HaNavi himself would come and say to abolish one of them, we wouldn't listen. We'd pay no attention. Wow. What does that mean? It sounds like it means they're so important, no one has the authority to abolish them, even Eliyahu HaNavi. But the Meshech Chochma says it means something else. When is Eliyahu HaNavi going to come? To herald the Mashiach. And when's Mashiach coming? A day later. Which means if Eliyahu HaNavi comes, that means Mashiach is just a day away. And therefore, you might think, you know, we were in Golus, we needed this, but Geula is just 24 hours away. And what's the Gemara saying? Even if Eliyahu HaNavi says Mashiach is coming, you still need all of this until Mashiach actually comes. You need it for the next 24 hours also. That's what the Gemara says. Even if Eliyahu HaNavi would come, Geula is nigh. But if it's not here, none of those 18 protections go away. And what does this have to do with us, says Meshech Chochma? Once we understand how critically important the lesson the Jewish people taught us, the lesson that we taught us in Mitzrayim, the importance of protecting ourselves through their protective measures. They didn't have much else, but they had this because their protective measures was what stood them in such good stead to be able to be eligible for redemption. That is why protective measures become part of the Torah's own prescription for how to celebrate the festival of Exodus from Mitzrayim. It's a celebration of protection. It's a celebration of protective measures. And that's where the Torah itself provides a protective measure. From chametz, it says, don't eat chametz, don't even own it. What is that? It's a siag la Torah, from the Torah, because it becomes enshrined in the mitzvahs, the importance of protection. With that, we were zochet to geula, and that's how we celebrate the geula. And with this, we should be fortified as we strive towards the geula for which we're waiting for, not just for Eliyahu HaNavi, but for the 24 hours that follow and all that follows from there.